Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. We're going to turn our attention to the issue of American evangelical support for the state of Israel. Political reasons, theological reasons, political support, monetary support, and why are some Israeli rabbis concerned about the ties between the state of Israel and American evangelicals? We'll talk about that with Aaron Wolf here in just a moment for the first half of this last hour. Wesley Smith joins us for the latter half to talk about several issues. First of all, we need to get an update on Terry Schindler Schiavo. The law that was keeping her alive has been voided by the judge. A Time magazine story tells us about stem cell research and the efforts underway on the part of big biotech to get stem cell research done on the so-called spare embryos from in vitro fertilization, and the latest on physician-assisted suicide in the state of Oregon. That's coming up. This is all in the third hour of Issues Etc. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for May is a book that I have been awaiting very anxiously for some time. Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. You ask a Lutheran, what does it mean to be a Lutheran? And they might give you all sorts of answers like, well, you know, I was born to a German family, you can tell by my last name, or something like that. Or, I love the hymns, those old standard hymns. They might talk about being raised a Lutheran. They might talk about, well, you know, I was a Catholic and my husband was a Baptist, and we just settled on Lutheran in between because it was kind of a little bit of both. Others might give more, well, bizarre and flippant answers like, pastor was just good looking. Or I thought the congregation was vital and alive. I don't really know what Lutherans believe, but boy, I like what happens there on Sunday morning. That, by the way, is becoming more and more a common answer, sad to say. Lutherans who can't tell you why they're a Lutheran. It's common on this radio program to have someone call and say, I'm a lifelong Lutheran, but... And usually what follows there is something that strikes at the very heart of what it means to be a Lutheran. What does it mean to be one of those who swims in the main channel of the many streams of the Reformation? Well, there's the answer in the title to our Issues Etc. book of the month for May, Jesus at the Center. The book is written by Pastor Daniel Preuss, a regular guest here on Issues Etc. It's $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it either online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under our What's New section, you'll find the book there. You can also order it by telephone by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Now, Concordia also has two bookstores in the St. Louis area, and both of them carry Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center, our Issues Etc. book of the month for May. At 3558 South Jefferson, their main store there at Miami and Jefferson, or here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton, follow the signs to the Concordia Publishing House bookstore, and you'll find our Issues Etc. book of the month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center by Pastor Daniel Preuss, $12.99, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org. Aaron Wolf is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. He's associate editor of Chronicles Magazine, and he joins us from Rockford, Illinois, to talk about American evangelicals and their support for the state of Israel. Aaron, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd.
Can you describe the relationship? And we're not talking about all evangelicals, but many, between many American evangelicals and the state of Israel.
Evangelicals who hold to the theology of dispensationalism believe that God has made an everlasting covenant with the seed of Abraham, which they believe is embodied in modern Jews. This covenant guarantees modern Jews, according to their perception, the right to all of the land that the Jews once inhabited in, as described by the Old Testament. And so based on this belief, they reject all the Palestinian claims to portions of their historic land in the Middle East, and they believe that God will support the United States as long as we support the state of Israel.
What kind of support are we talking about that the evangelical feels the Bible requires of him and them corporately for this modern state of Israel?
Well, they believe that they should only elect politicians who pledge their support to Israel, so representatives, senators, and even the president. And so if a politician comes along that, for example, supports the Palestinian, the idea of a Palestinian state, or even as President Bush did in the recent roadmap for the Middle East, talked about the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. They believe that that's contrary to God's will, and so they apply pressure politically through groups like the Christian Coalition to these representatives and say that we're not voting for you if you continue this stance. They also collect millions of dollars through various organizations and give that money to groups in Israel. In some cases, it's to bring more immigrants, more Jewish immigrants from Europe to Israel to settle there. In other cases, they're just giving money to support various charities in Israel, which is a good thing. And in other cases, they're giving money directly to political organizations, such as the Likud Party, which, you know, is considered the extreme right in Israel. Ariel Sharon is the current prime minister of Israel, is a member of the Likud Party. And so by virtue of that support, they're supporting the ideas of Likud and other even more extreme Israeli groups who wish to take away citizenship from Palestinians, who are doing a number of things to curtail Christian mission work in Israel, and who engage in a lot of what we might consider as Christians immoral policies in terms of killing civilians and support for a military, the Israeli Defense Force, that often retaliates against suicide bombing, which of course is abhorrent to any Christian, with its own level of violence and terror.
Aaron, before we talk about the story that occasions our conversation of the Israeli rabbis and their concern about these ties between evangelicals and the state of Israel, are these American evangelicals, are they right or are they wrong regarding the modern state of Israel and therefore their support of it?
Well, Christians traditionally have held that Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of all of the promises of God in the Old Testament, and that includes the land promises. When even St. Paul points out that the promise was not to seeds, but to a seed, and that that seed is Jesus Christ, and that he is the end of all biblical prophecy. And so for them to say that no, a race group or an ethnic group is the heir to these promises is simply mistaken, and it goes against the way that the apostles taught us to do exegesis on the Old Testament, to interpret the Old Testament in a Christological light.
Now, the story, according to the Associated Press, Israeli rabbis speak against ties with evangelicals. Prominent Israeli rabbis are, for the first time, speaking out against Israel's profitable alliance with evangelical Christians in the United States who have funneled tens of millions of dollars to Israel. That's the headline and the first paragraph of the story. What is the concern here on the part of these rabbis in Israel?
Well, this is a growing concern that's been in place for a number of years. The Orthodox, we have to back up for just a second and talk about the Israelis, because Americans think of them in a kind of monolithic sense, that they all sort of hold to the same beliefs, and there's a wide diversity of belief, political spectrum in Israel, and religious spectrum. And so there is a strong element of very orthodox, almost radically orthodox Israelis in Israel. And these rabbis and these councils of rabbis hold a lot of power in the civil realm when it comes to matters of marriage and divorce and families and children in Israel. And that group has consistently spoken out against the more secularist, Likudnik power brokers of Israel taking money from evangelical groups from the United States. It just so happens that this is becoming more and more prominent in Israel now, and there have been several articles in the mainstream press about it.
So what's the concern? Is that the money comes with strings?
Yes, that particularly the whole issue of proselytization in Israel, because the vision that the Orthodox have for their country is for a land that is completely occupied by Jews, Jews both ethnically and of the Jewish faith. And so the presence of Christian groups in Israel is, they see, as a threat to this. Now, people like former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Ariel Sharon are much more secularist Jews, and while they recognize the importance of the Orthodox to sort of keep their society together, they also are quite happy to take money from American evangelicals. In fact, Benjamin Netanyahu once spoke before the Christian Coalition here in Washington and said that they're the best friends that the Israelis have. However, there's always been this kind of give and take in the political and social sphere in Israel, and at any one particular time, the Orthodox element will cause a stir and will call for the right-wing political parties in Israel to propose measures to ban, for example, proselytization, Christians evangelizing Jews, and those kind of measures have come up. One came up in 1998, another one in 2000. And so there is kind of a divergence of opinion here in Israel, and yet the influence of the Orthodox on the more secularist political power brokers in Israel is kind of on the rise right now, to the extent that many Christian groups, and these are established Christian groups, Roman Catholics, various Orthodox, Lutherans in places like Jerusalem, are finding that their leaders, their missionaries, and even their pastors and priests are being told that their visas are not going to be renewed and that they're going to have to leave.
They can no longer work. It's a work visa in Israel.
Yes, that's right. There was an article on this in the Christian Science Monitor recently, where the Vatican is saying that this is, quote, the most difficult situation in living memory for the church in the Holy Land. That's the extent to which this crisis is occurring, that so many of these workers who used to be able to get a visa, or rather an extension on their work visa, in a matter of half a day or so, and now they've been told for weeks on end that the status is unsure, and that they might be forced to leave the country.
Now, what is the current state of religious freedom in the state of Israel? How does it play out, especially with the issue of being able to proselytize or to publicly preach or teach the gospel of Jesus Christ?
There's been a law on the books in Israel since 1977 that loosely forbids proselytization. Missionaries are allowed to proselytize. However, there's always a catch with it. In other words, various Christian groups that have to make deals in order to gain property, in order to gain visas, in order to come over and establish a presence in Israel. So it's never been clear that Christians have absolute freedom to preach the gospel. There's also kind of a tier structure where groups who have been in Israel for a longer time, Catholics, Orthodox, and to some extent Lutherans and Anglican, get more privileges. However, the freedom diminishes when we're talking about Israelis who convert to Christianity. Very often, Israelis who become believers, are baptized in the Christian faith, lose property, they lose their jobs, they lose government benefits. And since Israel is a very socialist state, there's a big government and a lot of income is redistributed in social services. This is very significant, and it amounts to sort of a lack of freedom for the gospel over there.
Now, this is interesting. So it sounds as though, and tell me if I'm painting this too harshly, you can go ahead within certain bounds proselytize, but we're going to put the onus of the law on those who convert. In other words, the disincentive is not to forbid proselytization, but essentially to have some sort of punitive measures, be they legal or financial, against the convert to Christianity.
That's right, and it's not something that's always clear on the books in terms of Israeli law, and therefore it's something that can be applied rather loosely. In other words, if a particular Israeli converts to Christianity and he belongs to a church or organization that has put out literature in favor of the Palestinians and their right to return or supports the idea of a Palestinian state, well, then that Israeli is seen as a threat to the solidarity of the Orthodox and their particular political outlook. And so in times like that, then these laws can be applied. If a group is seen, and this is how it's been in the past up till very recently, that the more evangelical groups who sort of promote a quasi-proselytization, that is, they talk about Jesus Christ, but then they also talk about dispensationalism and this idea that God has kept, a separate covenant with Israel. Those types of groups have had less of this kind of, we might say, persecution, or at least discrimination, as opposed to Roman Catholic, Lutheran, Orthodox groups who try to be more balanced on the Palestinian question. So a lot of the application of these laws and these threats and punishments has to do with what type of Christianity that you convert to. Having said that, as this recent article indicates, the Orthodox are not comfortable, even with taking money from these very pro-Israeli evangelical groups. And it sort of reminds me of the inverse of this, which happened in the United States with the whole kerfuffle that arose over the Mel Gibson movie. Ted Haggard of the National Association of Evangelicals, after he saw the movie and heard a lot of Israeli groups, or rather Jewish groups in the United States talking about anti-Semitism, said, look, you've got to give us this movie because, after all, we give all kinds of money to your people over there. And it was kind of a quid pro quo, like, you got to at least give us something here or else, we might just pull back some of our money.
Why, in terms of, you observe the culture in the society, Aaron, why is Israel an ally of the U.S. and vice versa?
Well, back when the Cold War was going on, the United States had to pick who we were going to support in the region. There was a time in which we thought that we might be more friendly to Arab peoples, and in fact we were to even folks like Saddam Hussein back then, because the newly forming state of Israel had a number of ex-communist and ex-Trotskyites who were there, and we thought that the Israelis at first, and this back in the late 1940s and 50s, might be more beholden to the communist mindset. But when we saw that we had an in with them and we began to support them and we gave them arms and money and something like $100 billion and counting in actual dollars that we've given to them since the beginning of the Cold War, in order to establish a presence in the area against the Soviets. Well, that presence is all, or rather our desire to establish that presence was back then and has continued to be bolstered by this growing element of Christian Zionists, the evangelicals who believe that God is behind the state of Israel, and that if we fail to support them, if we fail to defend them, then God's judgment will come upon us. So there's been a political element, there's been a religious element, and now we sort of talk about them as our ally in democracy, the only Western-style democracy in the area. I guess there'll be one soon in Iraq, but right now we have Israel. And to an extent, that's true. They have their Knesset. They have voting over there for many issues. However, there is very clearly a race-based tier system in this Western-style democracy where Israelis do benefit more from the government. In fact, our State Department, and again, we're talking about a very socialist society, our State Department reports that there is a discrimination against non-Jews in Israel, something like two-thirds of the amount of social dollars or social money goes to those groups as opposed to the Israelis. So if you want to buy a house, if you want to get a loan, if you want a job, those kinds of things, preference is just flat given, according to law, to the Jews there. And then you also have this tug of war that goes on in the Knesset, where you have groups like Likud or the Orthodox Party who clamor to take away rights, civil rights, from non-Jewish groups. And there have been any number of resolutions, for example, that Likud has put forward in the midst of Palestinian violence and the Intifada, designed to take away citizenship from Palestinians. And now, of course, we see this sort of squeeze out that's happening of Christian groups.
Aaron Wolf is our guest. Aaron, would you be kind enough to give us just a few minutes on the other side of the break so we can wrap up our conversation? I have a couple other things that I'd like to ask you.
Yes, sir.
Aaron Wolf is associate editor of Chronicles Magazine. He joins us from Rockford, Illinois. We're talking about the concern of some Israeli rabbis regarding the support of American evangelicals for Israel. It's not only political support, of course, it is also financial support. You can read Aaron Wolf's columns on the web, and I recommend that you do, at chroniclesmagazine.org, chroniclesmagazine, all one word, .org. When we come back, we'll wrap up our conversation with Aaron Wolf. I'd like his thoughts on Nick Berg and on Abu Ghraib before we let him go on the on these two issues. And Wesley Smith will round off our conversation here on Issues Etc. from the Discovery Institute, an update on Terry Schindler-Shivo, the Time Magazine story you might have read on stem cell research, and physician-assisted suicide in the state of Oregon with Wesley Smith in the last few minutes of this hour of Issues Etc. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, what does Aaron make of the recent change in policy toward the Palestinians?
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Why do Lutherans believe as they do about baptism, confession and absolution, the Lord's Supper? Why do Lutherans insist that Christian preaching be the preaching of law and gospel? Why do Lutherans worship the way they do? You'll find answers to these questions in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center by Pastor Daniel Preuss. The book Why I Am a Lutheran costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it from Concordia Publishing House by calling them weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center by Pastor Daniel Preuss. 1-800-325-3040.
The Bible, what makes it so special?
Answers with Ken Ham.
one of North America's most popular Bible conference speakers. Well, Ken, the so-called holy books of the Hindus and Muslim religions are claimed by their followers to be inspired. So what do I say to people who say the Bible is just a book like those supposed holy books?
Well, holy means of divine origin. So it didn't originate from man, but from some divine being. But all three of the holy books you mentioned can't be true because they contradict each other. Now, the Bible makes a claim that Jesus is the only way, the truth, and the life, and that he died for our sins and was raised on the third day. Christ also said that no one comes to the Father except through believing in him, which contradicts every other holy book I know of. Many people think that all religions are the same, and so there are many paths to God. But it's very clear that Christianity is very different from all other religions. For one thing, Jesus Christ is a living Savior. After being raised from the dead, he appeared to over 500 eyewitnesses. The founders of all other religions are decaying in their tombs. In other words, we have the word of a living Messiah, Jesus Christ, our Creator, Savior, Redeemer, Counselor, and King. The Bible stands alone when compared to other holy books. It's the only authentic and true holy book.
The Bible is the true history book of the entire universe. That's the theme of Ken's brand new booklet, The Seven Seas of History. It's available free on our website, answersradio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. 77% of America's sixth graders have a TV in their bedroom. If your children have a TV in their bedroom, do them a big favor and take it out. The more immorality and disrespect children see on TV, the more they are inclined to act that way in real life. But it is difficult to monitor what our children are watching when they are in their bedroom. Take the TV out of their bedroom. When your children complain, use those complaints as an opportunity to explain how much you and Jesus love them. Jesus only wants what is best for them, and parents act on his behalf. Tell your children that you want to do everything possible to help them grow up to be mature and faithful Christians, and that includes removing the TV set from their bedroom. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Issues, Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights. www.bethanylcms.org. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Aaron Wolf has agreed to stay with us for a few minutes here on the other side of the break to conclude our conversation with him regarding American support, American evangelical support for Israel and several other things. Very briefly, Aaron, what do you make of the attempt on the part of Ariel Sharon to try and get the withdrawal from Gaza? And he was pretty much voted down on that when he made an attempt to get it through the parliament there.
This is why the election that in which Sharon was made prime minister saw one of the lowest turnouts in the history of Israeli prime minister elections, because this kind of policy attempt and the failure thereof was something that most Jewish people just saw as more of the same partisan politics, and that it wouldn't get them anywhere and wouldn't bring peace to their neighborhoods. And so Sharon is, and even in his Likud party, they're grasping at straws. And the reality is that they're just not going to see the kinds of concessions from the Palestinians that they consistently are looking for. The settlement, the pullout of Gaza, was conditioned on them being allowed to keep over 140 settlements on the West Bank. That's something that the Palestinians would never agree to, and even the pullout from Gaza is something that the ruling Likud party, Sharon's own party, would not agree to.
Two other issues in the light of this, because there's a kind of a final question hanging here. First of all, your thoughts on the events at Abu Ghraib?
The Vatican has come out today and said that this is a greater blight on the United States than even September 11th. That's a strong statement. I'm horrified by these pictures. They indicate to me a number of things. I think that we have a whole generation now that's grown up in an amoral culture, and so statements such as "I just was never shown the Geneva Convention," or "I just didn't realize what we were doing, what we were being ordered to do is immoral," really just don't fly in the presence of God, who's going to judge the world. So I think that the excuses that are being made don't hold water. However, I think that there is a large problem here, and reports today are indicating that that this was something that was happening not so much as an official policy from the U.S. military, but rather under the direction of these private security firms that we have employed in the Iraq mission. There's a particular group called CACI that sent a couple of leaders over there, Stephen Stefanowitz and John Israel. You'll see their names more and more in the paper in coming days. This is kind of frightening and actually ties into our earlier conversation. These two fellows in this private security firm actually went over and had some training by the Mossad and by the IDF in some of the prison camps in the occupied territories. In other words, these Israelis were teaching these private security firm members how to humiliate a Muslim in order to get him to give out information, to break him down. And when we see these pictures of men being either sodomized or simulated sodomy, and public nudity itself is something that, of course, we're offended by, but it's particularly inflammatory for a faithful Muslim. And so the impact of these images on the war on terror is just astronomical. It's inflamed Muslims around the world, and in fact, we were just saying when the pictures were coming out that this can't happen without there being some kind of horrible atrocity, terrorist atrocity that follows. And of course, we saw with this horrible, just barbaric and animalistic execution of this really just innocent American civilian in Baghdad, where we're occupying as a reprisal from, not from the Iraqi people, but from Al-Qaeda. And my, what just a horrible, horrible tragedy.
Now, I want to be careful that you are not misunderstood as saying, well, we deserved, or worse yet, Nick Berg deserved what he got at the end of apparently this Al-Qaeda group's knife.
Heavens, no. I mean, this is unspeakable barbarity. And first of all, it's not, he can't even be reckoned in an Islamic sense as an eye for an eye. However, because the Abu Ghraib prison was not executing these prisoners in these unspeakable and horrific ways. But even as Christians, obviously, we have to look at that and say, you know, Lord, have mercy. There's no way that really any civilian would deserve something like that. And in the current theater of war, I can't imagine any prisoner of war, unless he's convicted by law of horrible crimes, being executed, and certainly not in that manner.
Finally, Aaron, with only 30 seconds, if it's true that the Abu Ghraib guards, the people who gave them the orders to do these things to the Muslim prisoners, were being trained by Israelis, and this was from the Israeli handbook on how to deal with Palestinians, why do evangelicals, who decry what even their own soldiers would do, the American soldiers would do to Muslims there in Abu Ghraib, why would they give Israel a pass?
Two reasons. One, there's a kind of cognitive dissonance that happens when this kind of news item is reported, because American evangelicals just refuse to hear. And so immediately when they hear a report like that, they decry the source. They say, well, that's from the leftist press, or those are the liberals, or those are the ones who want to tarnish President Bush or Donald Rumsfeld. The second is that their commitment is based on a misinterpretation of Scripture, and so they are convinced that this is the word of the Lord to support Israelis, and that they have a right to the land, and so if they do, then that means that those who stand in their way, they can be taken care of. In some cases, evangelicals will go as far, and not many, but some will say that, you know, killing the Palestinians or ethnically cleansing them is what they deserve. This is not what the Jewish people think, however, whether in the United States or even the majority of them in Israel. And I think that we found that most Palestinians and most Israelis are tired of seeing their children killed, and they would like to see a peaceful resolution. They don't share the extremist views, either of the evangelicals or of the Likud party, or certainly of Hamas and Islamic Jihad.
Aaron Wolf, thank you for the extra time, and thanks for being our guest again on Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Aaron Wolf is associate editor of Chronicles Magazine. He joined us from Rockford, Illinois, where they publish. Chronicles Magazine can be found at the web along with Aaron Wolf's articles, chroniclesmagazine.org, chroniclesmagazine.org. The remainder of this hour, we're going to spend some time with Wesley Smith. We need an update on Terry Schindler Schiavo, because the day after we talked with Wesley, the law that had been passed especially for Terry in order to keep her alive, the last desperate measure on the part of the legislature in Florida, was voided by a judge. We're also going to talk about Time Magazine's story on stem cell research and physician-assisted suicide in the state of Oregon. Wesley Smith, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Time sure passes quickly when you're having fun, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Tell us about Terry Schindler Schiavo and the law that was standing between her and her guardian husband.
Well, Terry's law, as it is known, was passed in the midst of Terry being dehydrated to death. What it basically says is this, that if it is intended to create an additional check and balance, because we're talking about state action that would cause somebody to die, in this case, taking a guardian with court approval, taking away a helpless person's feeding tube so they die by dehydration. And what the legislature passed was a law that says if there is a family dispute in such a case, and if the patient had not created a written advance directive saying that this is what she would want, then if the governor believes it is important to do so, the governor can step in and suspend the dehydration indefinitely pending further investigation, which Jeb Bush then did, and Terry's life was saved. Now, Michael Schiavo, with the aid of the ACLU, which is highly ironic, then attacked, sued Jeb Bush, saying that this law is unconstitutional, which was in front of Judge Baird. That's different than the case in front of Judge Greer, which is the one in which we've discussed previously. There's no guardianship plan in effect, so Michael doesn't really have power under Florida law over her, but nobody seems to do anything about that. And Judge Greer is the one who ordered her dehydrated to death. Judge Baird, when the case was filed, and before Jeb Bush had any chance to even file pleadings in the case, said that the law was presumptively unconstitutional because it violated Terry's right to privacy, which, of course, is what he eventually ruled. And the Court of Appeals said, well, that doesn't mean he's biased. So you can see that in Florida in this case, which I think has become a power struggle between the executive branch in many ways and the judiciary, and between the bioethics establishment that sees people like Terry as disposable and people who believe that Terry is equal and has as much a right to life as anybody else. I think this is a right to live case, not a right to die case. You see that the wheels are greased to end her life.
Briefly, is there anything that can be done now? What's the path? You look at it as an attorney. What's the path ahead in order to try and forestall the death of Terry Schindler?
Well, the path ahead is the appeal, which has been filed by Jeb Bush, It was filed immediately. They anticipated it, too, considering what Judge Baird had said before Jeb Bush even had a chance to file pleadings, as I mentioned. That goes to the Court of Appeals. I'm not real enthusiastic about the Court of Appeals saying that Judge Baird is wrong, because the Court of Appeals has previously never said, and it's the same Court of Appeals generally, has never overturned Judge Greer. Then, supposedly, it would go to the Florida Supreme Court. Whether or not they take it, I don't know. And if the Florida Supreme Court, which is a very liberal court, although it seems to me liberal should be against this dehydration, but, you know, that's me. If they rule against Terry, then it would potentially go to the United States Supreme Court, which I think would be unlikely to try to intervene in a state case like this. It's a very difficult situation. I do think there is one way out, and that has to do with the issue of Michael Schiavo under Florida law, while being officially the guardian of Terry Schiavo, having no powers to act over her because he did not file the guardianship plan for prospective approval by the court. And the court and the Florida legislation, the law, specifically says that it is the approval of the guardianship plan that gives the guardian a power to act over the ward. There is no guardianship plan in place, and thus, under Florida law, Michael actually has no power to act over ward. Over Terry, in my view. Now, I'm not a Florida lawyer, but that's how I looked at the statute. In my view, that might give Jeb Bush an opening to, as I wrote in my Weekly Standard piece, to step in and have Florida take custody over this helpless woman, because she may be the only helpless, you know, incapacitated adult in the United States in which nobody actually has legal authority, technically under the law, to make decisions for her. But Michael is making these decisions for her to make her die without that, under the color of law, when the law itself says he doesn't have the authority because he didn't get the plan approved.
All right, the next thing I want to...
If that makes sense. I know it's legalese, but it's the way it is. Judge Greer has abdicated his responsibility which is mandatory under Florida law, to require a guardianship plan. He has allowed Michael 6 extensions of time, so there has not been a plan in place for 3 years.
Well, I certainly hope that that is, I mean, it sounds like a thin straw, but you certainly would hope that that would be, at least, if you're going to have a guardian, at least have a plan. Wesley, the next thing that I wanted to talk to you about has to do with this story in Time magazine. It just makes me very frustrated to read about the stem cell research and the efforts on the part of both states and big biotech in those states.
Well, you're frustrated. I was interviewed for an hour and a half by that author of that article and talked to her about a lot of the things we've talked about on your program, none of which made it into the piece.
You're kidding me.
No, I kid you not. I don't care that I wasn't quoted, but there were things that I told her that belonged in that piece. And in fact, one thing she wrote, which drove me crazy, which was this. She said, quote, if there is any hope for a cure for the Zucker, which was a patient with diabetes, and more than 1 million other Americans with type 1 diabetes, the most debilitating form of the disease, it may lie in a revolutionary new field of research based on manipulating human embryonic stem cells. She's basically saying embryonic stem cells are the only hope. But there is a recent study published, which I mentioned to her, that in which mice with type 1 diabetes, the very kind mentioned in the Time magazine article, were given adult human spleen stem cells, and Todd were completely cured of their diabetes.
Okay, Wesley, is it that the reporter in question fails to distinguish between the vital distinction that we've made so many times?
No.
Between embryonic stem cell research and adult stem cell research?
No. She knew it. We had an hour and a half conversation. She understood the distinction. What I don't understand is how something that is patently false like this, when she has didn't only talk to me, I know she talked to Richard Dorflinger, who knows more than I do about some of this stuff. He's with the Catholic bishops. She quoted him to basically say, well, the Catholics are against it, which in liberal media is a damning of it, right? But the stunning thing is, She didn't even get into the issues of human cloning. We talked extensively how this state is falling apart financially and how this would be $6 billion in debt. We talked extensively that it's a constitutional amendment, none of which made the article. It's almost an advocacy piece. So, you know, the idea that media is giving your listeners a fair representation of these issues and others, as you know, is just hogwash. This is inexcusable, though, when there are studies that have been published in very prestigious papers showing that adult stem cells cure type 1 diabetes, and Time magazine all but says that embryonic stem cells are the only hope. It's a flat-out falsehood. And what I think happens, and I don't know this, but this is my supposition, is she talks to me, she calls the big biotech people, and they say, oh, good grief, you know, those people are just religious fanatic pro-lifers. You know, as she pointed out in her, she said in her piece, well, adult stem cells can't morph into all the various kinds of tissues. They don't really have the benefit. And so she, because they have PhDs, she just writes it down and just dismisses what we say when you know who's making the accurate scientific arguments are the opponents and the people who are ideologues and making statements that are unscientific and are not substantiated by the published literature are the proponents of human cloning. But the media gets very taken with credentials, and they think that the proponents are the rational scientists against the irrational religionists, and it's just baloney. I even pointed out to her explicitly that it wasn't just religious people and pro-lifers who opposed this initiative, but there were very left-wing secular environmentalists who also opposed this initiative. I even gave her the name of someone to call who's very big in that community who I work with in opposing that initiative, and it didn't make the story either. So tell me how you get a fair and accurate story presented when you at least have had the opportunity to present the case and it doesn't make the story.
Well, Wesley, we get you an honorary degree from some university, so you got some numbers and letters after your name, and then maybe they'll take your quotes. But I'll tell you,
they take Christopher Reeve's quotes, and he doesn't know what he's talking about half the time. I'm sorry. I'm not meaning to disparage the man, but I, in my new book, have quote after quote from him where he's flat-out factually wrong, and they never question what he has to say because he's disabled. Yet I work with a man named James Kelly, who is a paraplegic from an auto accident with a similar injury to Christopher Reeve, who has spent the last 6 years, 12 hours a day, researching this stuff, who has debated Christopher Reeve, who knows it inside out, and when you mention him, they say, well, he's not credentialed. Neither is Christopher Reeve. Good grief. Todd, my frustration is overflowing today.
Okay, you have outdone me in frustration. And I didn't think, when I read the article, I didn't think anybody could, but you definitely have outdone me.
Well, because I saw what she knew versus what she wrote.
Okay, Wesley, with only a few minutes left here, you have also written in the Weekly Standard, The Oregon Tall Tale, The Creepy Underside of Legal Assisted Suicide. What's the creepiness in this story?
This is a really big story that even the New York Times felt compelled to report, which tells you how huge it is. It's not getting nearly enough attention, of course, not getting any attention that I'm aware of on television. But legal assisted suicide in Oregon is practiced behind an iron shroud of secrecy. Nothing gets out about the practice. The state does not oversee anything. All the state does, even though they say there are strict regulations, the only regulations are that doctors have to follow certain rules, supposedly, and then fill out forms that they send to the state. Then once a year, the state regurgitates what the death doctors have reported. But you don't know what's really going on with real people, and the state is completely uncurious. For example, when the death doctor, they used to require the death doctor to report whether other doctors had said no. And there were many cases where other doctors had said no, and the state of Oregon never called the doctors to find out why, and now they don't require the death doctor to say that because they don't want to know if other doctors have said no. But what happened was a fellow named Michael Freeland, who had lung cancer,
We've only got about a minute and a half here for this.
He was depressed. He was delusional. He was allowed to keep his prescribed poison. He was prescribed the poison when you're supposed to have 6 months to live or less when you get it. He lived for 2 years after the prescription. A psychiatrist who, when he was put in a mental hospital, specifically let him keep his prescribed poison, even though he was suicidal, had guns in the house. They took out the guns, did not take out the poison. It shows you that vulnerable and defenseless people like Michael Freeland have no protection in Oregon, and the whole thing is nothing but a big con. There is no oversight of any kind to protect vulnerable people, and I also talk about the Kate Cheney case in that article, who had Alzheimer's and got assisted suicide, even though a psychiatrist had told the HMO in charge of her care that she didn't understand what was going on and that the real agenda was the daughters. So when actual cases come out, which are few and far between, we see the abuses that are apparently rife in this Oregon-assisted suicide, which is why it's all done in deep, dark secret, because that's the only way you can really kill people and get away with it and be deemed rational and compassionate.
Wesley, regardless of whether or not Time Magazine and Margot Roosevelt are willing to take your quotes as valuable as they are, your value cannot be overstated to our listeners here on Issues, Etc. Thank you very much for being
here. Thank you very much, Todd.
Wesley Smith is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and he's author of the book Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics, and a forthcoming book called Consumer's Guide to the Brave New World. You can read Wesley Smith's columns at his website, WesleyJSmith.com. That's WesleyJSmith.com. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk to Terry Mattingly of Scripps Howard News Service about how the religious left prays. He made some observations at a recent March for Women's Lives about how the prayer services that attended this march took place, and as opposed to how pro-lifers pray. And we can extend that conversation not just to pro-choice and pro-life, but to the left and to the right, how the religious left prays. We'll also learn whether or not the Quran and the Hadith can be used as a bridge, as an entry point, a portal to sharing the gospel with a Muslim. Our guest tomorrow will be Christian apologist Joe Goodell. And also tomorrow we'll hear from Gretchen Passantino to refute the claims that Apollonius of Tyana, I think it is, did miracles and rose from the dead, just like you know who, Jesus. That's tomorrow on Issues, Etc. The state, at the very least, should be protecting people who are not competent from themselves. You know, they talk about euthanasia as a euphemism for these things like physician-assisted suicide. But let's bear the word in mind that still is used, even by those who are proponents of physician-assisted suicide. 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 People who want to die. Is it loving to say to them, oh, we'll help you, or to say, let's change whatever it is in your life. Let's help you and comfort you so that you don't want to kill yourself. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.